Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Could the Fed-induced surge in interest rates actually be fueling our economic boom, not suppressing it? A contrarian view now popping up that says 5% returns on bonds and savings accounts is helping, not hurting the recovery. We'll break that down. Plus, insurance storm, shares of Traveler sharply lower on an earning and revenue miss. While premiums keep rising, so do the costs from catastrophic storms. We'll go inside the numbers. And later, ASML's really bad day and the ripple effect on semis, the monster rally United the day after earnings, and the options action on Netflix ahead of their results tomorrow. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Karen Feinerman, Courtney Garcia, Steve Grasso, and Tim Seymour. We start off with a contrarian view on the impact of higher rates on the economy. As yields in the 10-year hover near five-month highs, Greenlight Capital's David Einhorn joining a growing list of investors saying U.S. growth could be booming now because of rate hikes, not in spite of them. Einhorn pointing out to Bloomberg that U.S. households are getting a lot of income from more than $13 trillion worth of short-term interest-bearing assets like bonds and money market accounts. That is nearly triple the $5 trillion consumer debt load, and it nets about $400 billion a year in interest at today's rates. That money could provide some real gains if it's funneled back into the economy. Just look at the change in some key data since the start of the Fed tightening cycle. GDP is growing, unemployment holding steady, corporate profits and stocks rising. All this against the backdrop of higher rates. So could the current environment actually be supporting the economy and markets? Karen, what's your take on this very interesting view?
It is a very interesting view, although I want to sort of turn it on its head a little bit, which is, it is the cause of the GDP, you know, the GDP being so strong, the economy being so strong, is the cause of the higher rates. Yes, there are some benefits to that, like the ones you point out, which are really interesting. I also wonder how much tax income is boosted from all of that interest, extra
right.
income. We were talking about that before the show. This is the kind of thing we talk about before the show. And then there's also, there are some downsides as well. Obviously, it's really hard on the housing market. So, I think we can survive. I think it's the other way around, that it's the economy leading the market or leading rates higher, and that's okay.
But I guess we all sort of operate on this thesis that higher rates are not good for the consumer at some point. And I think that's what Einhorn is also saying, that there is a limit. But in this sort of sweet spot here that we have here, where it's restrictive but not too restrictive, you are earning income, that this is actually not a bad thing. Not a bad thing for the economy, for consumer spending.
Yeah, and I think specifically where you want to look at this is benefiting mostly baby boomers, right? They have over $76 trillion in net worth that they're now spending down. A lot of those people have the money in bonds, which they're benefiting from, things like money markets. They also have houses either with no mortgage or they're locked in below 4%. So it's like that huge generation, that's who's boosting the economy and continuing to spend here, and it will likely continue so when rates are higher. So where it's hurting is those like first-time home buyers can't get into the housing market. It's making things more expensive for the next generation. So it's hurting and helping certain parts of the economy, but it's why the general economy can continue to do well even while rates are higher.
And plus, we have to just enter into the valuation prism as well with the S&P, that if we're not going to get rate cuts, you can't hold this valuation. So I think you said, is it good for the markets? Is it good?
You cannot hold at these levels.
You cannot, because the market is looking for rate cuts on the horizon. That horizon keeps getting further away. So if the horizon becomes further away, the market's got to give something back. I'm still of the opinion we have more cuts versus less cuts. And the caveat is, what's more, what's less? I still think we get three cuts.
You think that? Yeah. Do you still think that we're going to get a cut in May?
No, well, obviously, May seems like a real, you would have to,
but
I think Rome
like
would
what
burn.
You were, what you were saying that shocked us all, left us sort of like our jaws hanging down.
And I thought up until the last couple of iterations of the CPI, I thought we were able to do that. Now with Powell backtracking off of that, I think Powell realized that his language was being interpreted with the market was rising, and he didn't want that.
Right.
So, but David Einhorn is talking about, you know, he's been on record about a year ago saying sort of the same thing, but saying it's not good for the market, but it's good for Main Street. I don't know if you can make that separation between Main Street and the market anymore. I think we're too long in the tooth with that argument. I think gas, eggs, cheese, meat is hurting the average guy.
So just inflation of stuff and services.
Inflation of everything. You ask anyone who's trying to go on vacation, right? That's what's happening right now.
So although they are getting higher wages, and I do think companies could be more productive. I mean, that is the whole AI, right, sort of pixie dust. If you can be more productive, then earnings could rise, and you can even the same multiple and still have a higher stock market. But, I mean, we're just in this idea of thinking rates are so high. They are not so high.
No,
they are around, I don't know, the 50-year average or longer of the 10-year is a little higher than here. So we've had good times with this rate. It's just the giant change from zero is, you know, that needs some adjustment. But there's been a lot of good economies in this rate environment.
Right, including this one. Tim.
Yeah.
And I guess what we're sort of trying to get at is what is the impact of a higher rate scenario on consumers, on the economy? And are we sort of, overestimating or maybe underestimating the strength of the economy in light of a higher rate? I mean, a lot of people said 4.75% is going to be terrible for the stocks. Maybe it's not. Maybe 4.75% or 5% is not bad for the U.S. economy.
Well, somewhere Steve Leisman will be smiling when I reference that. I think real rates haven't been this high in a long time. And although we're stuck, and the Fed has acknowledged we're stuck on inflation, coming down to their level, I think it's a pretty interesting. But I mean, you know, Steve is I think he's right. I mean, like, there's inflation everywhere, which is, by the way, why there's no way they're going to cut in June. It's impossible. It's actually technically impossible. We've got one more CPI number in April. The May CPI comes out the morning of the June meeting. They can't even opine on that. So June is gone. And I think September is a real question. I think the fact that people have come in from 5 to 2, I think 2 is challenging. So back to, are higher rates ultimately net good for the consumer? Courtney's right to signal those that actually are net positive in terms of their balance sheet. But I think it's the opposite for much of, call it the middle class, even middle class baby boomers. So people that don't have a lot of savings. What's interesting about this whole theory and this conversation is, yesterday we were saying, what happened to the banks? I mean, shouldn't the banks be the greatest beneficiaries of this very same thesis in terms of net interest income, their ability to basically borrow here and lend higher in a higher rate environment? And look, it was a great day for banks, by the way. And I don't think that there's anything particularly wrong with banks as long as credit doesn't fall apart here. But it's a fascinating time. I do think it's a great time for the 60-40 portfolio. I think it's a great time for people to have an income portfolio that gives them an opportunity to weather good times and bad and actually make money. And fixed income is really, for the first time in 20 years, for many people alive, as an asset class to invest in.
Our next guest sees a reaccelerating economy as a problem for the Federal Reserve. Torsten Slok is a chief economist at Apollo Global Management. Torsten, great to have you with us. Before we get to the Fed and what you think, which is no cuts in 2024, I do want to ask your thoughts about this sort of thesis that higher rates are actually good and good for the consumer. Net-net, is that true?
Well, I think there's some very important nuances in that discussion. If you owe money to someone, then higher rates is not good. If you own fixed income, then higher rates is good. So that's why there's a bifurcation when it comes to consumers in terms of who is it that's being impacted by rates going up. Yes, if you have fixed income assets, if you live off fixed income, then higher rates is certainly most helpful. Whereas if you owe money on your car, if you owe money on your credit card, if you owe money on your house, which generally tends to be younger households because they generally have higher debt when you're young, that means that younger demographics, and this is what the New York Fed data is showing, they are absolutely being negatively impacted by seeing delinquency rates going up on auto loans, delinquency rates going up on credit cards. So it is a bit of a double hit where some parts of consumers are benefiting, some parts of consumers are being hit. While at the same time, you also have had, because of the Fed changing their message in November and December, that asset prices have gone up. That adds the additional dimension that is not only about my cash flow as a household, it's also about your assets. And the very significant increase that we have seen in the stock market since the Fed on November the 1st meeting began to say, well, now we are cutting rates. We have seen a $10 trillion increase in the market cap of the S&P 500. That is a significant tailwind to consumer spending. That's the reason why the economy is reaccelerating. Retail sales has been strong. Hiring has been strong. Inflation has been strong. These are not just statistical flukes. This is absolutely because of the tailwind coming, in particular because of the stock market going up, home prices going up, and also these cash flows that are coming in particular to middle and higher income households.
So I think it's interesting that you think the economy is reaccelerating. It is very strong because basically the data points that the Fed saw in, and interpreted initially as a bump in inflation, you actually see that as the beginning of a trend?
Absolutely, because I do think that the communication from the Fed basically for 1.5 years before the December FOMC meeting was that interest rates are going higher, 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 higher. That meant that there was no PE deal activity on the exit side. There was very little issuance in IG, very little issuance in high yield, very little IPO activity, very little activity in M&A. So that's why the consequence of now them saying, well, now rates are about to go down, it was that we got a boost to financial conditions. And as you can see in the chart, the implication is that the Fed now needs to work even more on getting inflation under control. So, Melissa, to your question, I do believe that rates are going to stay higher for longer. And you can see market pricing in this picture here is telling you that, yes, rates may be eventually coming down a bit, but we're still going to stick at a level between 4 and 5%, which is dramatically higher than the zero, essentially, that we had from 2008 to 2022.
Torsten, it's Karen. Thanks for being on. So what would you put as the likelihood of a cut versus a hike from the Fed as the next move?
Well, let's first talk about what the market pricing is saying. And as you know, the market is now pricing that the first cut will come in September. But the market is actually beginning to price, admittedly in small single digits, that there will actually be a hike already at the meeting in May. And what is the market thinking? Well, the Fed Fund Futures curve is telling us that, well, maybe the Fed could be proactively saying, hey, we got to do more. So I don't think they will hike in the May meeting. But it's very interesting that the distribution of what the Fed will do is beginning to tilt more towards rate hikes coming. I don't think, as you also talked about earlier, that we will get any more hikes during this cycle for a lot of different reasons, partly because of course, the election is upcoming, but also because of the base effects on inflation are that there is more lift in inflation in the second half of this year that comes off when we get to December and into next year. So I do think the Fed will be articulating the way that Jay Powell did yesterday of saying, we will just stay higher for longer and we'll just have to wait a little while longer before we ultimately get what we'll see. So what I view at the moment, to back to Melissa asked about before, what we're seeing today is really a sugar high coming as a result of this boost from the stock market going up. Again, $10 trillion added to household balances. Remember, consumer spending in 2023 was about $19 trillion. So we have added in wealth roughly half of consumption last year. It is a significant tailwind to restaurants, hotels, airlines, concerts, sporting events across the board. Consumer spending continues to really look good when it comes to the next several quarters.
I guess the question, Torsten, is how long do you think this sugar high lasts? Because it's sort of a weird sort of cycle here, because if we stay with rates right here, then maybe the sugar high can be sustained. But that sugar high will, I would think, inevitably power rates to go higher, which would then be a cap on equities and perhaps the reason for equities to turn lower.
Exactly. So I do view that that sugar high here for the stock market going up, supporting consumption at the moment. I do view that again through the lens of, well, there's still consumers who have a lot of debt that are being more and more and more negatively impacted by high interest rates. And that's also the same thing on the credit side. There are firms that are highly levered in tech, growth, venture capital is particularly unattractive at the moment, because by definition, if you invest in venture capital, you're investing in firms that have no cash flows, have no revenue, have no earnings. So therefore, those firms that are sensitive to interest rates, those households that are sensitive to interest rates, will continue to be negatively impacted. So that's why we have this tug of war between those who own assets are still doing well, whereas those who owe money, they're not doing particularly well. And that's exactly to your point, Melissa. We will eventually see that succeeding from the Fed, slowing things down and getting inflation down. But that's where, to answer your question, I still think we have at least several more quarters ahead of us with this tailwind still supporting, in particular, consumption and services.
Torsten, great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Torsten Slok of Apollo. Several more quarters. That's not bad, Tim.
Yeah, no, it's not bad at all. It's a fascinating dichotomy. I think he's definitely talking about that divergence between the healthy consumer, the healthy corporate, and that which has a lot of debt. And I just think that's really where we are. I am sure that we are going to see credit issues. I am sure that as the credit market is always smarter, there are places to, I think there are probably issues right now. Having said that, what we've also seen from the stock market is that the stocks that have really been outperforming, look at what's been going on in the real economy, that is more, I think, illustrative of the type of backdrop we're talking about here, where high interest rates are also benefiting some of the industrial companies, some of the companies that also have pricing power. What we're also seeing is you know, whether we were talking about LVMH yesterday or Diageo, which is the name that I talked about on my final trade last night, you see the companies that had that burst of consumer discretionary spending that was, I think, artificial in COVID, have worked through a lot of that. And they're suffering now. I mean, meanwhile, they were outperforming for a long time.
You know, I think a lot of this has to do with labor hoarding. And I think labor hoarding came out, but there's no one qualified for a job. You can't get any applicants for a job. So they wind up holding on to the employees they have and they pay them more. So wages have been increasing. But they're waiting for rates to come down. How long can they wait for for interest rates to come down to keep that crew of people they have working for them? And if that keeps getting pushed off, do they start firing? Do they start laying off? We're seeing it with the tech companies now, but that's for a different reason, right? But what happens when you start to see Main Street starting to lay off because they're saying, okay, well, rates aren't coming down, so I can't hold on to these workers anymore? Then I think the market comes in. One last thing. We're in election year, I promise. We're in election year cycle. That historically, the president, the incumbent that's in, if you're cutting rates, you get reelected. If you're raising rates, which de facto you're raising rates if you're not cutting in this environment.
But if you're not doing either.
You don't. Because right now you still have QT. You still have QT, so that's de facto raising rates. And if you're not and inflation's still there, it's still a high rate environment.
Yeah. And you also have the perception on behalf of the American voter that the economy is not good.
Right.
That they are worse off than they were when President Biden was first elected. And that's a hard thing to shake.
It's a hard thing to shake, and it's almost impossible. But when the changing narrative, as long as you have a job, that cures a lot of ills.
All right. Let's get to United Airlines flying higher after posting better than expected earnings last night. A strong forecast helping that stock soar more than 17% today. That is its best day since November 2020. The jump coming even as airlines expect to receive fewer aircraft while Boeing's headaches continue. United also facing its own FAA safety review. Other airlines taking off today along with United. Look at that group and how they responded. Courtney, what do you think about airlines?
Yeah, and I think we've been talking a lot about this, where people are having to choose what they're spending their money on with inflation. And travel has just been one of those areas that the demand has not slowed down. And that's what we're seeing when United came out today. So keep in mind, they were actually doing worse than most of the other airlines beginning of April. So take this with a grain of salt. They're doing really well, but after they were doing much more poorly than everyone else. But I do think the airlines continue to look at a positive space. I would prefer like a Delta over United Airline, but especially when you're seeing business and international travel come back, they're both going to benefit from that.
Leasing those A321neos, Tim, to satisfy demand, that was huge for United in this quarter.
It was a big deal. And so that reaffirmation of the 24 guide, I think, you know, I think I used maybe three, maybe even four varies ahead of very good last night to say that, that's what those numbers were. They were fantastic. They gave the street visibility into where they are right now, both in terms of their airline dynamics. I think this is a bottom-up story, not a top-down. As much as I agree with what Courtney's saying around travel trends, I think maybe those travel trends might even I think they may be peaking more than they're accelerating, but I think the operational performance of United was extraordinary. That includes, I think, something like 7 to 9 billion in CapEx on average per year, 25 through 27. That will lead to free cash flow. The street loves that. I think there's obviously now upgrades galore. You've had an intraday move from the day before to where we got intraday high or even where we closed. I mean, it's almost been a 23% move for a stock that had underperformed Delta over the previous 6 months by 25%. So now what do you do with it? I think you have upgrades coming. I think you can probably own both airlines here for a trade. I am a trader with airlines.
Coming up, Lily's lullaby, a potential storm cloud for Boeing, and a streaming binge ahead of earnings. How Eli Lilly's weight loss drug could give you a full night's sleep. Boeing's latest headwind as a whistleblower testifies on Capitol Hill. And if the options pits are binging or booting Netflix ahead of results tomorrow, all that ahead. But first, a chip crunch for ASML, that stock dropping as sales come in short. The details from the quarter and the impact on the semi space when Fast Money returns.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. We've got a buzzkill on ASML, the semi-equipment manufacturer, down 7%. Its worst day since June 2022. Q1 sales coming in lower than expected, down 21% year-on-year. While profit beat estimates, the company did stick to its full-year outlook. But bookings for the company's machinery dropped 61% from the prior quarter, this sending the rest of the chip stocks tumbling, including Arm Holdings, which sunk 12%. And this sort of tells you that maybe its main customers, like a TSMC, as well as a Samsung, they've got a lot of inventory that they have to themselves work through, and therefore they're not ordering a lot of this equipment. Karen, you were thinking that maybe the reaction was a little muted.
Actually, I know. In that, is this potentially the canary in the coal mine? Now, a lot of analysts feel like, all right, the story's completely still intact, and they had always expected greater revenue next year than this year, and we saw some analysts even upgrade. But I can't help, given how expensive the sector is, or how far it's come. You can make arguments that it's not that expensive. I was surprised that we didn't see a bigger reaction. Obviously, we know NVIDIA was down 3% and change, which isn't gigantic. And so, I buy into this story. I own NVIDIA, I own Dell, and it does make me nervous that are we going to look back at this and say, oh, we should have known when ASML missed?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different tentacles out of this story, so I don't negate what you're saying. And we could look back on it and think that that was the pinnacle moment of it. TSMC, we're going to hear from them. We're going to see maybe the developing color of the story. But it's still NVIDIA's story to lose. So it's I would be a buyer of NVIDIA on any of these pullbacks because it's not directly related to them at this point. It could be.
Courtney, what do you think?
Yeah, and I think it's this one quarter is going to be hard to say because they tend to have pretty lumpy transactions. I mean, this is the low quantity, really high expensive equipment. So you tend to get, especially as some of these other industries are preserving their cash flow, you can get a pullback like this. So I don't think this in and of itself is a problem. But I do think, to your point, it has come so far that people are going to be much more critical of the valuation of the price if you have any sort of dip like this, which you're having. So their whole story is saying, well, this is the transition year. Next year, as people start to focus back to AI and you need these equipment upgrades, that's when we're going to see it. Right. So I think that's the question is, do we see that? If you believe that story, it's a great long-term play. If you're skeptical of that, you know, maybe you stay on the sidelines.
Yeah, it's the UV lithography machine that is the highest value machine that ASML makes. That's the machine that's needed for AI. That's the machine that's banned from China. And it takes 18 months to manufacture. So to Courtney's point, you know, there is a lot of lumpiness when it comes to that. And that should be sort of the caveat when you take a look at the bookings number, Tim. Cantor actually came out and said, buy on the weakness. Would you?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on. There's obviously the momentum in the trade. Remember, also, this is kind of a European AI play, and I think it gets very crowded in the back that there aren't as many across, you know, look at the Euro Stoxx 50 and those opportunities. That's just kind of a technical view. Also, as a guy that you know, has to focus on that for a European or a global focused ETF. But I think that the orders number was a big deal. Margins were better. The problem is that people have, I think we framed this pretty well, anywhere from kind of 60 to 80% growth next year in 25. And so the bar is very, very high here. But I think the overall focus on the semiconductor group in terms of, is this really now starting to break down? Remember, if you look at the SMH, which is the ETF that tracks the SOX, I don't know, we're somewhere around 212 or something like that. The day after NVIDIA reported that gangbuster, so the next trading day, 4Q number, and I think that was early February 10, 11, 12, something like that, we're kind of right back there. They've given all that back. They've underperformed the S&P by 6.5% over some of this time. And it's just something to think about. This leadership has been critical, I think, for the market. And I am very focused on this breakdown.
There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Catching some Z's with Zepbound, how Eli Lilly's weight loss drug could help patients get a better night's sleep, and what it could mean for the market for GLPs. You won't want to snooze on this one. Plus, Boeing's whistleblower on the Hill. But there could be more storm clouds brewing for the plane maker. The latest tailwind facing the name. Ahead, you're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Results from a new Eli Lilly study today finding that its GLP-1 weight loss drug, Zepbound, could help reduce sleep apnea over the course of 52 weeks. Patients both on PAP therapy and non-PAP therapy experienced nearly a 60% reduction in symptoms. The findings have not yet been peer-reviewed in a medical journal. Mizuho's Jared Holes also noted that 30 to 40% of sleep apnea patients are not obese, which could open tirzepatide or Zepbound to a new market, because one always thought that it would be the people who suffer from obesity who would benefit from this. But if they are not, then it's an entirely different population of patients here.
Right. And this to me sounds like it's more of an insurance, like who's going to pay for it? Because that's been a big question of how is it going to be paid for by patients. So I think it's more to do with insurance companies and making this drug more accessible to a host of other people. So that's great for Eli Lilly. But if your symptoms go down by 60%, you still can't breathe 40% of the time. So you're still going to have an issue. I think it's a bullish call for Eli Lilly. But as a whole, I think you're going to need a bunch of different solutions to solve the same issue.
Well, the episodes of breathing problems while you're sleeping is reduced by 60%. So you still have those problematic episodes of hypopnea and apnea while you're sleeping. But it is a step in the right direction. The thinking is also that it's a reduction and not an entire cure. And so therefore, drugs will still have to be used, breathing devices will still have to be used, and there still might even be surgical interventions to cure sleep apnea. So it's not like this drug can address it and therefore all these other things go away, which had been the sort of binary thinking initially when we heard about this study.
Well, that's what we're wondering, why is Inspire not down?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That, okay, the trial sounds good, but it wasn't good enough to for you to not need anything else. The whole thing, though, is so amazing. The number of different applications of these drugs, it's just extraordinary.
Yeah. And so, therefore, does it does it merit this valuation?
Does it merit getting insurance coverage?
Mm-hmm. And some are saying, yes, it'll open it up to Medicare coverage at this point if it is for sleep apnea. And Lilly is going to apply to the FDA.
Yeah, that's the big thing with this, is that these insurance companies, Medicare, are saying, well, if it's just for weight loss, we're not going to cover it. But if it's for these other things, then we can. So I think hopefully that will be a benefit. More people are going to be able to get it covered by insurance. I am curious. So they're saying, okay, it's going to reduce it by 60%. But also being overweight, I think, also can contribute to sleep apnea. So if it's helping both causes, is it more than 60%? I don't know.
Does it help prevent populations that would have the issue?
Right.
Does it help populations that
would have
sleep apnea?
By not becoming obese, do they not develop sleep apnea?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's that element to it, too. Coming up, Boeing's bruises continue as the company's whistleblower outlines safety concerns. There could be some more turbulence in store for the plane maker. We'll explain next. Plus, a big loss for Traveler stock as shares tank after this morning's profit miss. How rising insurance costs are weighing on the space. Next, Fast Money's back in two.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks closing in the red with the S&P and NASDAQ both notching a four-day losing streaks. The Dow down about 50 points, its seventh negative session in eight. Shares of U.S. Bancorp lower today after reporting revenue decline and cutting guidance. The bank also increasing its provision for credit losses. And some after-hours action to bring you. Discover Financial posting a revenue beat. Las Vegas Sands beating on the top and the bottom lines. And SL Green higher after their results as well. And Duolingo jumping on news that it will be added to the S&P Mid-Cap Index effective April 22nd. It's up 6%+ right
Magnifico.
Now.
Magnifico.
I know you learned that from Duolingo. Meantime, a Boeing whistleblower testifying today on Capitol Hill saying the aircraft maker is putting out defective airplanes and alleging that he was threatened for raising red flags. It's just the latest cloud hanging over Boeing. 3 years ago, the company entered a deferred prosecution agreement with the DOJ after two fatal crashes of its 737 MAX jets. Those issues that led to the midair blowout early this year could mean the company violated that agreement. And Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal told me on Squawk Box this morning that if that is the case, the company could be held criminally liable.
The liability would be tied to those deaths, but also to the continuing pattern of a broken safety culture and manufacturing defects that were known and concealed or covered up through this pattern of retaliation. And again, not jumping to conclusions, there needs to be further investigation.
So what is next for Boeing and how does this all impact the stock, which is down 35% this year? Joining us now, Jefferies aerospace and defense analyst, Sheila Kayalu. Sheila, great to have you with us. I'm first of all curious what you thought of what happened with the whistleblower testimony today on Capitol Hill and whether or not that adds to sort of this case that Senator Blumenthal is putting forth, that there is a culture and repeated pattern of just quality issues.
I mean, clearly Boeing is struggling, right? The share price tells you Boeing is struggling. There's a CEO change in place. There's a search for a CEO. There's a board overhaul. So there's a lot of things going on at Boeing that reflect the fact of the January 5th incident, essentially with Alaska Airlines and the safety culture, that when we go back to the 2018-19 and the two crashes that led to that 2.5 settlement, as you mentioned. So clearly a lot going on at Boeing. I think the testimony today from the different panels, it's hard to put it in context. An employee working on the 787 program, later moved to the 777 program, says there's issues on the 787 as well, in addition to the 737 MAX. Stepping back, the 787 has not had any major incidents. It has had a relatively decent safety culture. And just let's bear in mind, Boeing is producing the 787 at a current rate of 5 a month. That's very different than the pressure to up volume from, 20 a month to 40 a month to 50 a month on the 737. So there's a lot less volume pressure, which could stem, quick fixes on something like the 737 MAX.
So in terms of the violation of the deferred prosecution agreement reached with the DOJ, Sheila, is that on your bingo card? I mean, does that factor in at all to your outlook for Boeing?
Everything is on the bingo card when it comes to Boeing. There's always something new. clearly that wouldn't be positive. If they violated it just within the 3 years, and they do have a safety system in place. It's just apparently too cumbersome for people to document it. But so they do have one in place. I think that would just add to the slew of issues. But regardless, I think looking forward, and that's what we have to do, is we're going to have a new CEO come in. The timing of that is unknown. I think the first thing that new CEO is going to do is take out that $10 billion free cash flow target, throw it out the door for 25, 26, and say we're going to slow production until we hit certain safety measures and maybe fixes into the facilities. I mean, yes, Boeing touches a lot of suppliers. Yes, each plane has a million parts. But at the end of the day, these are two big factories, one in Renton and one in Charleston, that have to be managed. And of course, Spirit Aerospace Systems, if they decide to take that in-house, which is currently in talks with Boeing to be taken out.
Just curious, if it is found to have violated that deferred prosecution agreement, what do you think that means for the stock? And then the next step would be, if they're found criminally liable, I mean, I don't know what fines there are. I don't know if it involves, another agreement at that point. The management will be involved. Prior management will be involved. How do you sort of play that out?
I think it's hard to play it out in terms of investor sentiment and the share price performance. Clearly, another ding and a fine would be very negative for the stock, in that you would have, additional debt in place, and their debt balance is already in the $45 billion range. So that wouldn't be positive from that perspective. But, Dave Calhoun is leaving, not because of anything he's done. The former management no longer is at Boeing, right? And I think what we have to take back, and Department of Justice investigations do take a long time. Some companies in our coverage have had a decade of DOJ investigations. And who this is tied to on a criminal basis is very hard to lead it up to top management. And we've seen plenty of turnover on the program manager lines, whether it's the 737 MAX or the 87. So I think, as Senator Blumenthal said, to pin it to somebody is just going too far ahead. And we do see these criminal investigations and these DOJ investigations last close to a decade sometimes.
Sheila, thanks. Sheila Kailu of Jefferies. Tim, how do you think that it would, how do you think it will play out?
A crowded bingo card, which I know you play a lot of bingo, Mel, equates to a lot of pressure on the stock, but it doesn't necessarily change where free cash flow probably begins to reaccelerate again by the second half of next year. I read Sheila's research. I agree with her view on free cash flow for this company. And I also remind folks that Boeing's underperformance over the last 6 weeks is obvious. And obviously since the Alaska Air investigation and the changes at the top. But really, most of the underperformance of Boeing over the last 3 years were not not related to regulatory dynamics, but related to COVID, related to the absolute shuttering of the airline industry. We are in a very different place. Boeing is going to have a free cash flow yield of probably 5 to 8% by the time we get into 26. Like, they report next week. I think it's good for the stock to get focused back on numbers, and I think it's going to be a pretty interesting time.
Coming up, Travelers taking a tumble, the insurer with its worst day in nearly 4 years. What analysts got wrong about this report and why investors are running for the hills, that's next. Plus, options traders rolling out the red carpet for Netflix ahead of earnings tomorrow. We'll dive into the action right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Record rainfall battering the United Arab Emirates and surrounding countries on Tuesday. 10 inches of rain, 2 years' worth, fell in the UAE in less than 24 hours, causing unprecedented flooding and shutting down the busy Dubai airport. Authorities diverting flights, halting traffic, shuttering schools and offices for safety. The UAE has denied reports that the rainfall was exacerbated by cloud seeding. In neighboring Oman, 18 deaths have been reported due to the weather. Meantime, Travelers weathering its own storm after posting an earnings miss this morning, thanks in part to higher than expected catastrophe losses, the stock dropping more than 7%, its worst drop since June 2020. Contessa Brewer's here to take us inside those numbers. Contessa.
Yeah, and it just continued to plummet even when the call was going on and the company was highlighting all of the excellent results in the quarter. The shares just slumped. They didn't bounce back. The executives were laying out these ways that the financial picture has improved. Its return on equity, its net investment income up double digits. It hiked its dividend by 5%. But the catastrophe losses, Melissa, they were significant. $712 million. Most of that from thunderstorms. I mean, and here's the thing. Travelers is hiking the rates on premiums. Its underwriting results improved dramatically. When asked on the call whether Travelers has achieved enough on rates for those increases to begin to decelerate, the answer was not really. Travelers said in auto insurance, prices will very gradually moderate. But on property insurance, rates are going to continue to increase in response to elevated costs of paying out claims. There's two things I want to point out, and this will matter to other insurers in the line to report their earnings. Travelers says that materials and labor and replacement costs, they have come down from last year, but they're still generally higher. And then lawsuits continue to be a real challenge for the industry. They are costly and they are increasing. And then, okay, so three things. The thunderstorm damages, they're real. They're hard to model, but they're changing the way that insurers think about pricing coverage to homeowners. They say in every state where thunderstorms happen, they're rethinking how they approach those policies for homeowners.
There are thunderstorms in every state, Contessa. So I'm guessing that there are certain states that suffer more from thunderstorms than others. Are homeowners there? Are they destined to see increases then if they are, quote,
everyone,
unquote, rethinking?
Everyone is destined to see increases. It does not matter where you live. You're going to see an increase in your auto insurance, and if you haven't already, and you're going to see it in your home insurance. The thing is, in some states, those increases are going to be far more noticeable. For instance, Travelers was asked today about Florida. It's been a real problem in part because of the litigation, in part because of the way that they assign benefits. And Travelers was asked, hey, look, the legislature went in. They tried to address a lot of these problems. Are you willing to go back into Florida? And again, the answer was, I mean, I'm making it much more succinct, but the answer was no, we're not ready to do that.
And of course, for a lot of homeowners, you have to. I mean, they're in so many parts of life, you can decide, I'm not going to buy that, it's too expensive. But when it comes to insurance, you have to. If you want to get that mortgage, you have to have that policy in place.
I think what's happening, too, is that the way people are thinking about risk is, how much is your deductible? Where are you willing to cap out your coverage? Can you trade off on risk a little bit and say, I'm willing to trade off on maybe the hail and the wind? And then the thunderstorm comes and it turns out that the hail and the wind is a real threat and it causes more damage than you were prepared for. This is all happening in real time in every state in the nation.
Contessa, thank you. Contessa Brewer, who makes insurance interesting, right? I mean, this is fascinating what is going on here. Tim, how do you think about, you know, investing in insurers given the challenges they face?
Well, I think there's two things going on. First of all, insurers are also one of these groups that are doing a lot better in a rising rate environment. And we think about, you know, where they had to invest. And again, obviously, there's always a process of having to align and match up where liabilities are. But I think it's a higher rate environment, better for them. I can't speak to greater thunderstorms in Kansas versus, you know, New York. I will say that the insurance companies seem to me, and this is just a consumer's view, they're always going to force me to be overinsured. And with rising prices, unless, you know, again, if you talk about home insurance, if there's a bank that requires you have X insurance, the insurance companies are always going to make sure that they're covered. And I therefore, these types of weaknesses, especially that are around, I think, property and casualty, I think are worth buying.
You know, when you look at Allstate reports in the next two weeks or so, and if you start to get that discounted price based on this story, you might get a better entry into Allstate, and they've outperformed Travelers by basically 2-1. So you're always going to lose money when you're the consumer, but these companies figure out a way to make money.
Coming up, the need to know on Netflix, the streaming giant surging more than 25% this year. But should you binge or bail ahead of earnings tomorrow? How option traders are positioning? More Fast Money in 2. Welcome back to Fast Money. Netflix on deck to report after the bell tomorrow. The streaming giant up 26% so far this year, but options traders are feeling cautious ahead of the results. Mike Coe's got the action. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, the options market implying a move about 8% after they report earnings, and that's small for them. Six of the last eight reported earnings have been larger than that, and they are hedging, I think, buying the April 550 puts. We saw over 2,000 of those trade for $4.60 a contract. That's a little less than 1% of the stock price, and that would hedge some gains. If you bought the stock at the beginning of the year, it was 470. That would lock it in.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Courtney, how are you feeling about Netflix ahead of earnings?
I mean, it's definitely a company that's been doing really well. I think what's going to be interesting to see for them is we've had this actor strike. And so a lot of the other streamers like have not had as much content as they have because they get a lot of international content, which I think will hopefully benefit their subscriber growth. But that's what it's going to what's going to matter is what does their subscriber growth look like? How does their password crackdown looking? What does their advertising tier look like? Hopefully, if that looks good, it's going to be good for the stock. But we will know tomorrow.
Up next, final trades. Time for the final trade. Let's go around the horn. Karen.
Yes, I can't let the day go by without saying happy birthday to my twins, Kate and William. And they see, I still think that's how old they are. Aww. So that when they say, like, Mom, I'm going to get my own apartment, that's who I think is talking to me. Final trade, Meta, next week earnings. I like it.
Tim.
Happy birthday. LVS, not a real happy birthday after hours on these numbers, but I think the cash generation there is fantastic. Macau's recovering.
Courtney.
Delta, we talked a bit about the airlines. I think a lot of that looks strong moving forward. This is a great way to play it.
Steve.
Happy birthday, twins. Tapestry, I bought it around the 100-day moving average. I think it's due for a bounce.
Happy birthday, William and Kate. Thanks for watching Fast Money. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.